either low Earth or medium Earth orbit altitudes. And when you got that large number of satellites crossing overhead, how in the world do they arrange it so they don't hit each other? And periodically there's going to be gaps in the system. Do you remember the proposed number of satellites, Paul? I'm guessing it's a very big number. Go ahead.
Yeah, originally OneWeb needed 900, but I think they upped that number. I don't recall how many they went up to. SpaceX wants 4,000. In fact, they want to set up a factory. You know, like they're making boosters, and they're going to be making satellites. Instead of a car factory, instead of like making the Teslas, you know, SpaceX is owned by Elon Musk, so he's producing Tesla cars, you know, one after the other. He wants to do the same thing for satellites. So that's going to be the deal on that. And then there's another company, I forget what the name of that one was. So I think there's at least three companies involved independently from one another looking to get the, like you said, people that nowhere near, you know, internet, you know, there's billions, I mean, literally, I think they said 3 billion people that don't have the capability of being on the net, plus, if, you know, if you don't like what you're paying here, you know, hundreds of dollars we're paying for our system. Let me drop it. You know, you're going to have people that might, you know, cut the cable. You know, they might be going from the frying pan into the fire, though, with the satellites. Who knows what the cost is going to be. And, you know, you can get phone, you can get internet, and even TV from these satellites. Why not?
Now, I think I heard you say 900 satellites or maybe 4,000 satellites. Wow. I mean, each one of those satellites is in its own plane of orbit. You're going to have a whole lot of different planes of orbits. But somewhere the planes of orbits intersect each other, maybe near the poles. So there's going to be a certain number of collisions. How in the world do you avoid those collisions? On top of that, they have good reason to believe that the international agencies will give approval for this. If you're giving approval for an organization, even if they can afford it, to put up a 900 or 4,000 satellites, that number of things in space means that the next time you want to launch something like a cargo ship to the International Space Station, you've got to worry about hitting these things. Can they really be assured they're going to be getting approval for that number of satellites? I mean, where do they stand on the agencies that have to get the approval? Over to you, Paul, KQIW.
Yeah, first of all, you got to get the FAA involved, right, for all these launches. And then all the companies that are involved, there's a company called Vector. They would like to launch these things. It's a new one that's come out not too long ago. Another one called Firefly. They're involved with this type of thing, too. They would all like to launch orbital satellites to these companies. SpaceX, you know, of course, we know what their story is. In fact, next month, or I think later on in August, I'll have to check the date, they're launching 50 independent satellites, you know, within a couple of weeks from Vandenberg Air Force Base. 50. All these small satellites. Sats for different people and groups and countries. India, not too long ago, about 2 years ago, launched 104 satellites on one launch. And internet satellites would have to be, you know, spaced evenly apart. They all have to be tracked. I guess that comes under. Was it NORAD, I think, does that. They watch these tens of thousands of pieces of space junk and satellites. And then one time you had the Iridium satellite direct hit with a Russian Cosmos satellite. Direct hit. I mean, that was a lot of years ago before all of this was approved. So yeah, I'm with you, Dick. I don't even know how we're gonna see the moon with these things flying. I joke.
If you compare the cost, if I've got a group of people living in Montana or Utah or whatever who don't have internet service, and I compare the cost of giving them service as opposed to this thousands of satellites, obviously one is cheaper than the other. But that's just thinking domestically. Obviously, of those three, I think you said 3 billion people have no internet service. Awful lot of them are living in places in the outback of Australia and Africa and so on. So, now, the fact that I've got a satellite system that's capable of giving service to people who are living in a very rural area, that doesn't mean that the person living in that rural area has the resources to buy and maintain that system. I can't believe that somebody's going to give it to him for free. So the economics to me is a little bit spooky, but just that large number of satellites potentially hitting each other and the approval for that, that strikes me as a serious problem. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, and they're pretty good at putting these satellites in certain locations. Just recently, SpaceX launched five Iridium satellites, and then with it, they launched two other satellites, and they're following one another. I'll think of the name in a second, but two satellites, it's a deal between NASA and Germany. He built these two things. And the satellites are keeping an eye on one another to within the distance of half the distance of the thickness of your hair. You know, the precision is incredible. So I guess I have the ability to know exactly where these things are and you just, you know, launch in between them. You know, or when they're slightly out of plane, they'll know where this is. NORAD keeps an eye on all the existing satellites, and they, for instance, they'll notify the International Space Station. They use different colors. I think red and yellow. Yellow means, you know, we have to possibly move the International Space Station a little bit because there's something going to be within a couple of miles of you. And then that means cancel all EVAs. And then they go to a red. That means that's it. You know, you have to move it now. And they'll fire something up. You know, that's a module. They have thrusters on that or they'll use a progress ship that's already attached to the space station just to move it a couple of, you know, quarter of a mile out of the way in case there's, you know, they don't want any connection, any possible space junk or something to come near that space station. And they have that capability now. So, I mean, I guess with 10,000, if you add 2,000 more, I guess they could do it, you know. I have no idea how they're doing it. But by the way, they go all the way down to, I think they said, equivalent of like 2 inch or less, roughly around 2 inch pieces that are flying around in space. You know, but what about the one that's like one inch? You know, like a 1 inch nut. You know, you hit that with the force of 17,000 miles an hour, and you're going to do a lot of damage. I don't know. The space station has been hit by stuff before. Nothing serious.
Yeah, I think the impacts they've experienced, so did the space shuttle experience, things that created a nick in the windshield, very, very small pieces, you know, a fleck of paint, so to speak, moving at 17,000 miles an hour will leave a divot in the glass of your windshield. But NORAD is able to track things down to a certain size, but there's a whole lot of nuts and bolts and other things that they can't necessarily track, and you're absolutely right. One of those at that speed will penetrate and do a tremendous amount of damage. So in the process of launching these thousands of satellites, it's going to be other pieces of junk created in the process that are very difficult to track, and they represent a danger. So I'm having trouble believing they're going to get approval of this. And it would have to be a relatively low frequency. You go up to frequencies like Ku-band, as the OmniTrack system that was done by Qualcomm a decade or two ago. These systems were put on tractor-trailer trucks. That was operating in the Ku-band frequencies, but the individual antennas on, mounted on top of the trucks had a tracking antenna. Let me drop a... Inside of that radome on top of the truck, the antenna would literally track the satellite as it went across the sky. It would aim itself. And so, but that's an expensive installation. That's not something you're going to put into a rural area of, you know, Africa. Did they mention how the financing of this, of a person who lives in a developing nation, are you going to supply that service to him free of charge? I'm having trouble believing that. So, the financing for an individual customer in a developing nation, how does that come about, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the developing nation will have to be subsidized, you know, by their governments. You know, the people can't afford it. So, I don't know how that's going to work. Maybe other nations will chip in to help those nations. But eventually, yeah, it's a good idea, you know. Get all these people online, and you know you're going to have a lot of, you know, a lot more brain power on the internet to do it. You know, logistics behind it is kind of overwhelming. One other thing I forgot to mention, I just wanted to talk about this last field day that went by. This was a report by the ARRL. They used the Cassiopeia. Cassiopeia spacecraft was launched quite a few years ago, back a little over 5 years ago, launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and it has the capability, it has one of the instruments on board, and it's one of these satellites that, you know, look at the weather and everything, but Cassiopeia is, has a receiver on board that can tune to 40 meters. So for the last 2 years, and they did it this year too, they tuned the receiver to 7.005 megahertz. And as you know, that's the CW portion of the band. Let me drop it. So on field day, and every time I went over the United States, I went across the states around six times during field day, it was copying the signals. Field day, and they're using it to study the ionosphere. So they're actually using field day, this group that's in charge of this science satellite that's been flying around for 5 years, they use a field day to actually use it for science purposes. And they got a couple of groups in the middle of the country to when they said, well, if you're going to transmit, you know, on CW, leave it on, you know, 7.005, and, you know, that'll be your calling frequency. And they did that for them. And then this way, this year, they were able to find it real quick when they left the satellite in that one position, that one frequency. And they got a lot of science out of field day, and they plan on doing this every year now. I thought that was pretty good. And that came out of the ARRL. You might have even gotten that on a letter from them if you signed up with them.
Hello?
So that was one thing I wanted to cover. The other things were, I did have information about the Blazar, but we covered that with Roy. did an excellent job with the blazar and the neutrino story. And another topic we always talk about on here is, you know, well, finances with space anyway. Blue Origin is the company that has successfully launched, unmanned so far, a spacecraft called the New Shepard. New Shepard is a booster with one liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine attached to it that launches vertically from Texas. They have a launch complex there, and it goes up into space, suborbital, gets into space, and then comes back down vertically. Let me drop it. Before it comes down, it separates the capsule. The capsule will eventually be manned with half a dozen people in it, and that has so far successfully separated. Parachutes have come out. Heat shield is heat shield has floated down, and the parachutes have come out, and it's landed successfully in the deserts of Texas. But the booster comes back down and lands vertically the way it took off. They've done this 8 different times with a couple of different spacecraft so far. Now the third one has been built, and they've launched that thing a couple of times. And they're expecting within probably another year or so to actually start having people pay for the flight. Now, we've talked about another company doing this, which is Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic has a space plane. They're going to put 2 pilots, 6 people in their space plane, take off on a runway with the carrier jet, the White Knight, go up to 40,000 feet, get dropped from the carrier jet, and the spaceship 2 will take off and go into a suborbital flight into space as well. Well, those people have had their price locked in for a couple of years now. Around $250,000, you can get a ride with Virgin Galactic and drop it. Now, it turns out Blue Origin has, they figured out what the price is. Officially, they haven't said the price, but some of the reporters talked to people that are involved with the company, and they said it's going to be around the same price, $250,000. To do this, get into a rocket ship, get on your back, take off, and go into suborbital space, like Alan Shepard did, and Gus Grissom on their early Mercury flights. Six people at a time, with these great big windows. The windows are gigantic. I've seen the windows; very large. You get to float around for a couple of minutes and come back and land in back down in Texas. So I thought I'd bring that up. We always wonder, what's it going to cost, to get into space? And, it's suborbital, but now it'll have to do. Let me drop it. The same company, Blue Origin, by the way, it's owned by the richest guy in the world, this guy Jeff Bezos. He's also building the New Glenn. He names it after astronauts. He's got the New Shepard, after Alan Shepard, and now he's got the New Glenn, and that's presently being built in Florida. And that will be probably coming online in probably 2020, 2021. And eventually, he plans on having crew flights and tourists going up in this thing. So that's the future. It seems like a long way off to me, but these people have poured billions of dollars into the space program. Back to you, Dick.
The actual customer is going to be in space for some small number of minutes. It's a suborbital flight, if I understand correctly. And or is it one complete orbit? Do you take off from Texas, go around the Earth once, and come back to Texas? So what's the length of time that the customer paying $250,000, what's the length of time that he's actually in space? And from the opinion of Neil deGrasse Tyson, just going in suborbital. To him, that's not really going anywhere. You haven't gone to a place, as far as he's concerned. Over to you, Paul, KGRIW. So, how long is the actual flight from the customer's point of view?
Yeah, you got about, I guess, a little over 2 minutes in that first stage. Well, it's really only one stage. It's one rocket that shuts off. And then you continue to coast up to 380,000 feet, which is just over 62 miles high. And then you come back down again. So you don't leave Texas. And you come back down not too far away from where you took off. And in fact, the booster comes back down very close to where the original booster took off from. Virgin Galactic, well, same thing. You know, you're going to take off from a runway. Your spaceship is attached to the bottom of the White Knight 2. Four big jet engines attached to that. Takes you up to 40,000 feet like an airplane. So that'll be like flying in an airplane. You get up to 40,000 feet. You know, it's like bombs away. You go to bomb. You drop from the White Knight 2. Your rubberized type of engine comes on with liquid oxygen. And that ignites and accelerates you again to 62 miles, a little bit above, because that's the common line that gets you, you know, to 100 kilometers, and then you come back down again on a parachute. So you get a longer flight because you get a longer ride going up, you know, in the airplane with Virgin Galactic. So maybe you get more for your money.
And I think in past SpaceNet, you told us how many people have already signed up to put down a deposit. That's amazing to me, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, originally, back in 2012, when the first one blew up, not that it blew up, it broke apart in the air. They said the co-pilot pushed something or hit a button he wasn't supposed to hit. Well, this is a contraption, you know, the whole back of the plane comes up at like 90 degrees, you know, the plane's like in two pieces, and that's not supposed to happen until you're above the atmosphere, and this guy apparently hit it early as the rocket was on, and the whole thing just broke apart. One pilot lived, the other guy didn't. So at that point, they had 700 people signed up, and they already put down, you know, they had paid a full price. They put a down payment down. And then after that, they said, well, some people backed out. I guess they had a good reason to. But not too long ago, I read they still had 650 people signed up ready to go on Virgin Galactic. Officially, there's nobody signed up on Blue Origin yet, back in the day.
So if I understand correctly, 700 or 750 people put down a deposit. And if the final cost is going to be $250,000, they probably put down more than 10%, $25,000 or $50,000 deposit is a guess on my part. Wow. And the actual amount of time they're going to be in space is a small number of minutes. And if you count only the time you're in space, dollars per minute, rather expensive. We have that many rich people who think that they're in good enough health to survive this mission. The mission itself, during portions of the boost, I'm sure you've got something like 4 G's of acceleration and then some weightlessness. And everybody is healthy enough to go through that without any medical problems. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW. By the way, did they mention what kind of medical tests a person has to pass before you can become a passenger? I mean, if a certain number of people perish in the process of doing this, that's not going to give them a favorable press. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I know you have to have a medical okay before you even get down to Texas, but that's only the beginning. Then they check you out when you're in Texas. Or in case of Virgin Galactic, they'll check you out in New Mexico because you're leaving from Spaceport America. So, yeah, they said, like, for Virgin Galactic, you need to get down there, like, you know, early Friday, and then you'll go through all the, you know, medical, and then training, you know, for Friday, training for Saturday, and then Sunday, you get to get in Spaceship 2 and take off, two pilots and six passengers. So, at least that's a little company. You know, I got two pilots, and, you know, they're risking their neck when they're going up. In fact, Richard Branson, the owner of most of this, he plans on being the first one to be on the second it becomes a commercially accepted. He's going to put himself on this thing. So, you know, that gives you a little faith. The other one, Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos, I don't know what he's thinking. He's going to put six people on his spacecraft. Let me drop it. They're going to bolt them in with these, you know, I guess some kind of spacesuit type of thing, pressure suit. And no pilot, no commander, no co-pilot. Just six passengers get in there after being trained and everything. And then you're going to blast off. I don't think that, you know, that would be like me getting into a 747 and say, by the way, the pilot's still on the ground, and have a good flight.
There's one other thing that all of these customers, I think, are forgetting, because it is unpublished. Your astronauts that go onto the International Space Station or onto the space shuttle go through a tremendous amount of training and selection before they get a chance to become part of that project. So these people with tremendous amount of training, when they go into space, 50% of them spend the first 24 hours with space sickness. 50% of them, trained pilots, have space sickness, and that's not very well published. Therefore, maybe at least 50% of these people paying for this ride during the weightlessness portion are going to get space sick. It's going to be hard to enjoy that ride when you're space sick, and possibly the only way you can avoid upchucking an awful lot of materials to make sure your stomach is completely empty before you go. But that doesn't stop you from getting space sick. That just decides you know, how much result takes place. So I am guessing that 50% of the people during the weightless portion are going to experience space sickness, Paul. Over to you, KQRIW.
Yeah, I've read that many times. At least 50% of the people get deathly ill. And they can't wait until that feeling goes away. And sometimes it takes, you know, a day or two. So, although this is suborbital, you know, it's not going to last all that long. You know, it might be, you know, unpleasant for you and the other passengers. That's going to be a problem. And what about the psychological part? I don't know, maybe Rory knows more about that. What somebody would have to be used to before they get in. You know, you get into one of these things, they bump you into the seat, you know, and you pass all your tests, physical tests, and then you're sitting there waiting for this, you know, waiting for the countdown, and you get this rush that comes over you and say, I gotta get out of here. Next thing you know, you pull the seatbelt off. You're looking for anything you can swing to break the glass to try to get out of here. You know, where's the stop button? You know? You can't have that. You know, like you said, the astronauts are trained for this thing. They put them in confined quarters for, you know, days on end, and they see how they're going to react. I don't know. This is what they're thinking. We'll have to find out as time goes on how successful this is. You know, I guess if it goes on week after week, month after month without an incident, I guess, you know, they'll be good to go. KQRIWWS.
There's another effect that I just thought of, Paul. Will each of these customers be wearing anything like a spacesuit? Will they have any kind of protection from possible depressurization of the craft? If so, they're wearing something like a spacesuit. And when you're wearing something like a spacesuit, and if you then become seasick, that becomes a life-threatening situation. The combination of weightlessness, seasick, inside of the spacesuit means that the stuff that you're upchucking is definitely going to become a breathing difficulty. And as I said, that can be very life-threatening. So there's a lot of risk from depressurization if you're not wearing a spacesuit. And there's going to be a hell of a lot of risk if you are wearing a spacesuit. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, remember the guy that went up in the balloon a couple of years ago? Felix Ramheiser, he came out of... came out of Norway, someplace, and this guy was one of these guys that would jump out of, you know, out of anything, you know, he would go to any kind of height, and jump out of, you know, open up his parachute, last minute, jump off a cliff, you know, real daredevil. So, he got contracted by, Red Bull, they were the sponsors behind this, and they wanted to send him like 20 miles up in a balloon, and then jump out of this balloon with a parachute, you know, they wanted to beat the other guy's record from the 1960s, they did it as an experiment, they were testing spacesuits back then, and this one guy had the record, but this other guy, Felix, can't remember his last name, forget what it'd be. They put him in a spacesuit, you know, because he's going to go up in this balloon where there's no atmosphere. And it was a documentary, and they showed many, many times him freaking out that he could not stand the spacesuit, this thing surrounding him. He felt so trapped. And in fact, he canceled when we dropped it. The whole thing, that's it, I'm going home, you know, one of those deals. He just couldn't handle it. And then I think a year or so went by, they called him up, and they gave him another shot. I think he went to the psychiatrist and everything else. Whatever it took to get this guy straightened out, he finally was able to do it, and then he broke his record. And then some guy at one of the Google owners or something, a year or two later, he beat his record after all of that. But here's this guy, a daredevil, and he just couldn't handle the spacesuit. You know, he thought originally, no problem, you know, and then every time he put it on, he just freaked out back here.
And so he has to worry about getting spacesick in that spacesuit. I think his name was Felix Baumgarten. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's probably right, or close to it. He had an accent, I think it was Norway, but quite a character. I'm glad he finally made it, but, you know, in a big contract with to do this, and they spent, like, years preparing for it, you know, big deal. In fact, one guy that helped him out was the original guy that flew back in the 1960s. He's still around, and he was there coaching him and helping this guy through this. It's quite a documentary, you know. They do a good job. So, okay, I don't have any other topics, Dick, but if you have any other questions or anybody else, we're here. This is WS2N.
Yeah, let me settle this one more time, because maybe you told me and I didn't catch. Of all the people who are going to spend $250,000 to go into space, what is the current plan? They will or will not be in some kind of a spacesuit, Paul? If they're not in a spacesuit, then you got to worry about the cabin being depressurized. If they're in a spacesuit, then the cabin depressurization is not a problem. But them getting sick in that suit is a definite problem. So what's the current thinking? They will or will not be in spacesuits, the various brand names that are spending the $250,000. Over to you, Paul.
I saw that they will be in the spacesuits. Blue Origin has the blue ones. I'm not sure what color yellow ones have. In fact, if you watch the videos of the spaceship 2 going up on their test, the pilot and co-pilot presently have spacesuits on, and they're going higher and higher each time they do it. But yeah, let's put it this way. They look like pilots, but, you know, they're completely covered. If they lose pressure, they'll be okay. So, all the passengers will probably have to, I'm sure they will, because if they lose pressure, they're all dead. So they'll all be in some kind of pressure. Now, whether or not those suits are completely pressurized, or maybe, the pressure builds up in case, after there's an accident, who knows how they're going to have that set up, I don't know. But so many companies are involved with this stuff, it's incredible. One other company that has a billionaire, this guy Peter Beck, he owns a Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab has already launched a couple of rockets from... He built his own launch complex in New Zealand, the North Island of New Zealand. Let me drop it. He now wants to. He's licensed out of California, out of the USA, but he's flying out of satellites out of New Zealand. I think in a 300 to 400 pound class satellite. He now wants to launch out of the United States. He's trying to pick a launch complex. It's either going to be Kodiak, and then they give it another name, but up in Alaska or Wallops Island. And I think he had two other choices. I hope they choose Wallops Island. Closer to here in Virginia. But there's so many companies, like I said before. A company called Firefly, another one called Vector, and different countries are getting involved. Oh, by the way, Israel now is going to launch early spring. Let me drop it. They have a lunar lander built, ready to go. Out of the country of Israel, but this company in Israel has this lunar lander built. And they have a contract now with, apparently they have a contract with SpaceX to launch in early spring to land a rover. They just want to land a lander on the moon. Send video back. So look at all these people and companies, contracts. It's incredible. We had NASA, we had Russia years ago, government. But now you've got different countries. Spain is involved, and all these individuals with big money. I can't wait to see what's going to be going on 10 years from now. I know I won't be able to follow all this stuff on the net. It's just just too much. Back to you, Dick. WS2X.
Okay, Paul, you and I have just settled that the majority of the customers, most likely, are going to be wearing a spacesuit to protect from depressurization of the cabin. And we also can speculate that the weightlessness portion is going to create space sickness, maybe as much as 50% of the people. The combination of a spacesuit and space sickness creates a situation, and weightlessness creates a condition that is life-threatening. When you're space sick and something comes out of your mouth and it's floating around in spaceness and weightlessness inside of the spacesuit, you cannot breathe that material. So that's a life-threatening situation. I don't think there's any great fix for that. There's no glamour fix for that situation, now, Paul. You can see what I'm worried about, K2LAW.
Okay, I haven't given much thought to that, but you're right. That could put a big damper on it. Like I said, flight after flight, it might be okay. One person gets that sick where seriously injures, themselves or somebody else. And they plan. Now, you know, here's the other thing. When they get up to zero G, they're going to release the belt to fly around, you know. How are they going to get back? These are not trained people, you know. And, you know, somebody's going to have to call up and say, it's time to go back to the seat. You know, they're just going to automatically go back there. Well, I know if it was me, I wouldn't even hit the button. I wouldn't want to fly around. I'm going to stay attached to the seat because I might miss the window of opportunity to get back. Back to you there.
Well, but that problem of space sickness in a spacesuit in weightlessness, that's definitely life-threatening. You can't breathe that stuff, if you know what I mean. And if you're space sick, your body says, I'm getting rid of what's ever in my stomach. I don't think there's any way you can stop that from happening. How are you, Paul? I know this is not the pleasant portion of it, but we got to worry about the worst-case situation. And a certain percentage of these people are going to get space sick. Keep your eyes open.
Yeah, I agree. Well, at least they're not coming down on water, you know. Not coming back on land. That would be an additional problem. Imagine doing what Alan Shepard did and Gus Grissom. They were the only two that did suborbital flights from Florida. And they again, one was a 15-minute flight, the other was a 16-minute flight. That's it. They went up. Came right back down, landed in the ocean, and now there's waves. That would be a big problem for the average person. Bad enough with the launch and the space sickness, you know, imagine landing in a, you know, having the waves bobbing you around. It didn't end well for Gus Grissom. He eventually, well, they said he blew the hatch, but said it was an accident. It's never been resolved, but the hatch blew off, and he was out of there. And then that spaceship, was it Aurora, I think was the name of it. It sank, and he got pulled out by the helicopter. You know, but he was floating around in the sea all by himself at one point. Okay, does anybody else have any questions or comments for the net? So I have about 10 minutes or so. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. I think we put everybody to sleep. You know, they got space sickness listening to us.
I know it's an awful long shot, but I'll bet you Dr. Roy doesn't know of a way you can protect a patient from getting space sickness. I don't think there's any magic drug you can take to avoid that, but let's double check. Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
Change your pill the size of a tire. No, there's absolutely no way to kind of lock down your central nervous system. I mean, I'm sure there are ways of cupping the mouth into a separate vacuum chamber to decrease the damage possibly done, but all these this conversation is demonstrating a lot of problems with the technology. I think someone's going to get their backside sued.
But right now, everything we know about this $250,000 space adventure, tremendous amount of funds have already been dedicated. They're going to follow through with this, and we haven't heard methods of solving the problems we just discussed, because the problems we discuss is part of the unknown. The fact that all the trained astronauts get space sick, 50% of them get space sick for the first 24 hours. The public doesn't know that. Over to you, whoever wants to pick it up, either Paul or Roy, K2IW.
That people take when they're on the... down. I mean, right before the launch, that's one of those things, you know.
Well, it might help, but it's not going to 100% decrease your risk. So, yeah, they'll probably do that, and they'll probably have them not eat for many hours before the flight, but push comes to shove. Hopefully they're going to put some device in their mouth that's going to act like a vacuum cleaner just in case, but who knows what they have in store for them.
Yeah, did you ever see the train, they go on the parabolic arcs? They say about half of those people get sick too. You know, they just go one after the other, you know, they'll do like, you know, 20 different arcs in one flight. You know, for each time they get like 25 seconds of free fall and weightlessness. But, you know, they always, you know, to watch a lot of those films of those people doing that, they're always, they all have bags and they're trained how to use it. So I guess it'll be that type of thing, you know. Instead of 25 seconds of weightlessness, you're going to have like 3 minutes, and 3 to 4 minutes, and then that's going to be it. I guess they're going to roll the dice.
By the way, you know the slang for that parabolic flying aircraft that gives you 30 seconds of weightlessness? It's called the Vomit Comet, is what the airplane is called. And that's not just done for humor. I think there's a lot of truthfulness there, Paul, KQIW.
Yeah, the Russians have one, too. The one that NASA had is now done by a private company. So here you go, Dick. You know, we can't afford the $250,000, but maybe we can get Linemark to pay, you know, pay us because, you know, we do the tech net. You know, a mere $4,000 each, and we can go fly down to Florida, and we can get on the Vomit Comet, and it'll cost them only what, $12,000? You know. Do you think Leibach will pay for me, Roy, and then we can comment how great it was on the TechNet?
There's a member of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, ASLI, who got an award to fly on that airplane because it's one of these organizations that if you've got a lifelong dream, they will finance you. And he had a lifelong dream to fly on that thing, and they did allow him to fly. And I think he is a pilot, a private pilot. And I saw the movies of him on that flight, and he enjoyed it. Lucky for him, because of being a pilot, you get a lot of chances to protect your, to psychologically protect your body from space sickness, if you know what I mean. But the general public, I wonder what percentage of the people flying on that those parabolic arcs. It's only 30 seconds, but I'll bet you at least 20% of those passengers get sick. Have you heard any of the statistics along those lines, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, I heard half. I don't know if that's true. But, yeah, right now it's, they'll do one arc and then another arc. So each time they do this, they'll, I think I read they'll do like 15 or so arcs, maybe more. So you pay for this, and you train for this flight too. You know, they just don't let you on. That's what you do. Sometimes they have big groups on. When I was younger, I would have been first one online, Nick, no problem.
The good news on those flights is you're not wearing a spacesuit, and you, you've got a throw-up bag that you're capable of using. So there's a degree of safety there. But on these $250,000 flights, wearing a spacesuit, that strikes me as a very serious problem. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, and I can imagine what's going to go on with the orbital flights when if they ever get that far. You know, I mean, we've had private people fly before. Russians have taken them up many times. I think nine different times. You've had individuals get on the Soyuz rocket and blast to the space station, spend, you know, a week or 10 days or so on the space station. It's kind of come to a grinding halt over the years, but I think it's been done nine different times. But each one paid like, I don't know, $23 million or something, you know? $1 million. So, again, there's a big difference between buying parabolic arcs for $4,000 and $250,000 for a suborbital flight, and then $23 million for, they say more now for an orbital flight to dock with the space station. Wow. So, you know, eventually they would like to do that. SpaceX would like to have tourists, and so would Blue Origin. So, I guess we'll see that sooner or later. You know, you're going to have a lot of wealthy people doing this in the beginning. That's for sure. Back to you, Dick, with only 1 minute left. This is WS2M.
Right now, every one of our astronauts that get launched to the International Space Station are launched by the Russians. What does the United States pay for each one of those launches right now, if you happen to know, Paul? Go ahead.
The last I heard was about 6 months ago. I think it was $70 million, $70 million, where, you know, 10 years ago it was $20 million, and, you know, the number's been creeping up. I think they're up to $70 million.
Wow. Okay, this was Space Net number 707. That was Science Talk number 37. And that was the TechNet number 1707. Sending through you all. Bye-bye for now. And hopefully we'll solve some of these problems by next week. Over to you, Roy, for any final comments. AC2GS, thank you. KQIW in the TechNet. You got it, Roy.
AC2GS. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for everyone who participated, and even for those who just sat there and listened. If you got any comments, if you got any questions, if you have any answers, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want to check out any of the links of any of the articles that I mentioned, it's on a webpage. Just type in on your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. Thank you very much. Have a great week, and we'll do it again next Sunday.
73, and have a good night. Roy, Dick, anybody else that's listening, this is WS2N Clear.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Amateur Radio Repeater System.